Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by remembering the late award-winning journalist Elias Castillo. He died on February 11th in Redwood City, California, following a brief illness. He was 80. On November 8th, 2004, Elias Castillo published an opinion piece in the San Francisco Chronicle called The Dark, Terrible Secret of California's Missions. He wrote it after then California Senator Barbara Boxer proposed legislation to provide $10 million in federal funds to restore California's missions, which the legislation described as places where Indians and the friars lived in harmony. Well, Castillo's piece, which refuted that description, was read into the Congressional Record. The piece and the Congressional Record produced an outpouring of comments supporting Castillo's criticisms, and it led him to write his book, A Cross of Thorns. The book examines the enslavement of California's indigenous population by Spanish missionaries from 1769 to 1821. It details how the horrific treatment of Junipero Serra and the missionaries led to the deaths of more than 60,000 indigenous people. The book was published in 2015, just days after Pope Francis decided to declare Junipero Serra a saint. A Cross of Thorns is taught in many colleges, including UC Berkeley, UCLA, and Oklahoma State University. Elias Castillo is a three-time Pulitzer Prize nominee and the winner of 13 journalism awards. He's a former reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and the Associated Press, and he is missed. We were also joined by Valentin Lopez, chair of the Mutzen Tribal Band of the Costanoan Ohlone Indians. Valentin wrote the book's foreword, and here is our conversation. Hi, Elias. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm very glad to be here.
Well, thank you for writing this book. As someone whose family members are California natives, it was very hard to read this book because it's incredibly brutal.
Yes, it is.
How many people actually know the history of California's missions?
The reality that the missions were in reality death camps, that's what they were, is probably maybe less than 20%.
Are we talking about like the U.S. population as
no,
a whole or California?
California population.
So less than 20%.
Outside of California, they don't even have a hint of what, it's just what the Catholic Church has released on them. In the church's view, everything was just hunky-dory. The Indians loved the friars and the friars loved the Indians. And thank heaven for the friars for civilizing the Indians. Civilizing them, they had their own civilization. Prior to this, for thousands of years, they lived in a very sustainable way of life, and they had had it, like I said, for thousands of years. In my 7 years of research, which is going through books published by the Franciscans themselves, I discovered the letters that Serra had written. In a letter to one of the governors, it says, well, this is the only way to treat these Indians. They're a savage civilization, and the only way to control them is by blows. That's a quote, direct quote, blows. And another letter, he asks the governor to, this is regarding 2 to 3 Indians who had run away from his mission in Carmel, and he refers to the runaways as my lost sheep. And he asked the governor, for as those 2 to 3 Indians, whip them 2 to 3 times and make the punishment last for 2 months. Mm. Oh, and then here's the kicker. At the end of the letter, he writes, oh, and if you don't have shackles, we have some here. And with your kind permission, I can send them down to you. Raises the question, missions, they're treating the Indians wonderfully. What are they doing with shackles? They would be punished. The Indians would be punished for, as one French visitor to one of the missions, an admiral who was heading a very major French expedition of the Pacific Rim, visited Carmel 2 years after Serra's death. And he said, everything we have seen here reminds me of the slave plantations we have seen in the Caribbean. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, except for one word. Everything I've seen here is, on the part of the Franciscans, is, and this is the exact word he used, reprehensible. The Indians are punished for insignificant things they do, which, outside of the missions, no one would even notice. And then he talks about the whipping. He says, women are never whipped, but taken to a far and isolated place that their screams might not incite the men to riot. And he describes them as just, the Indians are sort of walking around in a sad trance. That when he described them as being like, it was that the mission was like a slave plantation. He also said that even the sound of the whip is common here. And then his successor, Francisco Fermin Lasuen, as a friar, of course, said, well, these Indians deserve to be, because they are uncivilized and savage, they need to be punished more often, because they are akin to a species of lower animals. And then another one, Friar Jeronimo Boscana, who wrote the first detailed description of the Indians' faith, Chinik-Chinich, that's the name of what he wrote, wasn't published until the mid-19th century, because the Vatican would not allow it to be published. And the death rate, and then finally, at the end, the last Spanish president of the missions, Mariano Payeras, Father Mariano Payeras, wrote a letter to his superior in Mexico City and said, asked him, actually, was pleading him, says, we have to do something. We have to come up with an alibi, or else we are going to get blamed for the deaths of all of the Indians in California. And all we have done for them is to baptize them, administer the sacrament, and bury them. We are the ones who killed the Indians. We did as we were told. And where have you heard that before? We did as we were told. And he adds that the Indians thrive outside of the missions. Once they're inside the mission and held there, they die within 2 years. He says there are no more Indians, older Indians. They all have all died. And the rest of the letter is along those lines. But this is, in effect, the smoking gun in which a hierarchy, member of the hierarchy of the Franciscan orders, admits we did it, we killed them, and we are killing them. Because by 1821, Mexico won its independence from Spain. But then the Mexicans came in and treated the Indians just as well for another 12 years. There was no let-up. And then after that, the 49ers came in, and the California government included killing the Indians. There was a militia formed. They sold state bonds to fund that, and the mission of that militia, which was armed by the state, was to kill all of the Indians, complete the genocide of the Indians. And that is little known. All of what I've talked about is little known because the Catholic Church has buried it. They buried it and they want it to stay buried. They don't want to release the letters. They don't want it generally known about the letters written by Sarah, Lasuen, and Payeras, and other letters by visitors such as the Admiral from France, Comte de la Preu. The history is there. You just have to find it. It took me 7 years to find it, and I did find it. It is irrefutable evidence that the missions were, in effect, in reality, death camps.
Elias Castillo is author of the new book that exposes the truth about the California missions, A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions. And now I would like to also introduce to the show Valentin Lopez. Valentin is chair of the Ama Mutsun Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians, which stretches from Santa Cruz to Monterey and inland to Mission San Juan Batista. And he wrote the foreword in the book, A Cross of Thorns. Hi, Valentin. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you. I know you drove a long way to be in the studio today because this is such an important issue for you. What was it like for you to collaborate with Elias to tell the truth about what happened to Native Californians at the missions?
Well, actually, the book was written at the time I met Elias. We started talking about it, and I was so thankful to read it because we had been looking for a piece like this for a very long time. You would just find little pieces, odds and ends here and there, but we knew that the story was not correct, was not telling the truth. So we've been waiting for a book like this that told the truth so that we can start, you know, having a campaign to get our true story told. We know the truth about Sarah, and we know that the story that's told by the Catholic Church does not represent the truth in any way. So how can someone who developed a mission system, and I want to talk about that for a half a second here, Junipero Serra was responsible for developing the mission system, and that system included going on out and violently capturing the native, the Indians, bringing them to the mission. And once at the mission, they were a slave labor force. They could not leave. If they didn't obey, they were whipped. The men were separated from the children and from the women. The soldiers would go into the women's dormitory at night and repeatedly and continuously rape the women. And the same with the children. So how can someone who was responsible for developing such a brutal system be considered a saint by anyone? In Mission Monterey, the Presidio was built right next to where the mission was. Because today it's Mission Carmel, but it used to be Mission Monterey. And in Mission Monterey, the soldiers would go in and repeatedly rape them. And so they moved the mission away to Carmel. And the church likes to say that Junipero Serra took a long journey to Mexico City to ask that the soldiers stop raping the women. Well, that's not true at all. Whenever Serra went down to Mexico, he went down there for the purpose of asking that the soldiers be under his control so that he can expand the Roman Catholic Empire even more. He wanted to put a mission down in Santa Barbara, but the governor of California or the commander of California wanted to build San Jose. And so there's a real conflict there. And so Junipero Serra, he went down for the purpose of getting control of the military. He did not go down there for the protection of women.
Yeah, and I've got to emphasize that that's exactly what he went down for. He wanted to control the soldiers that were stationed at the missions. Once it got, Serra made the formal protest, the governors, military commanders, they were not called governors, but they were military commanders. They had the same powers as governor. Were told to control your men. You're going to cause a major Indian war that we will probably lose if they all band together. And that's the danger of what your men are doing. And so the governors reined in their men. It was Governor Fagas who was the first one there, who just basically didn't care what his men did after they were off duty. But then in the later ones, they were told because of the fear of a combined attack by the Indians.
I'd like to add one more thing about Junipero Serra's trip to Mexico City. The Catholic Church, if you were to go to all the pro-Serra Catholic websites, they all talk about how Serra developed a 32-point California Indian Bill of Rights. And that's the first Bill of Rights in the United States. But they never talk about the specific points, and they never tell you where it's available or anything like that. That thing right there is nearly impossible to find. And we had a researcher who works with our tribe recently spend a week and a half, perhaps 2 weeks, looking for that document and found it. And what it is 32 points that Serra wrote to expand his control and his authority of the missions. He wanted complete authority over the Indians, and he wanted complete authority over the missions. At the same time, the Indians were starving to death because they didn't have enough food. Serra would not let the Indians leave the mission to collect their traditional foods. He wanted everything grown on mission grounds. And so the Indians were starving. And so, in those 32 points, it has nothing to do with the protection or the security of Indians. But yet all those Catholic websites say it does.
That's a real misnomer. It's not a Bill of Rights for the protection of Indians. It's just what he wanted. And, for example, Val talks about the Indians starving. Well, they were starving because all of the Franciscan friars he collected in Mexico to come up to California knew nothing about animal husbandry or growing crops. Mm-hmm. And in one mission, the crops had failed so miserably that the Franciscans decided, well, let them have milk. Well, these were lactic intolerant Indians after a certain age. And so it just made them sicker with dysentery. And these are the conditions that they grew up. The Franciscans were content to feed them ground-up corn with water added, which they called pozole, And once in a while, once in a great while, they would give them some meat. But most of the time, they suffered from disease, dysentery, venereal disease, and malnutrition, and depression from all the punishment they were getting. It was horrible. They were forced to kneel on ground, on stone floors, rough stone floors, for 2 hours, and had to go to Mass every 2 hours. If they didn't, they would be whipped.
Elias Castillo is author of the new book, A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions. He spent 7 years doing research on this book to expose the truth about the missions in California. We're also joined by Valentin Lopez. He's chair of the Ama Mutsun Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians, which stretches from Santa Cruz to Monterey and inland to Mission San Juan Bautista. And he wrote the foreword in the book, A Cross of Thorns. Do you know your history about California's missions? If you don't, you're not alone. Only about 20% of people in California do. Where did you get that number, Elias?
That's just a figure that I came up with. The majority of the population in California knows nothing about the reality of the missions. It's been covered up by the Catholic Church. If you go to one of the missions, you'll see the signage. It says, this is the place where the Indians came and to learn to be civilized. And they were taught how to make saddles and woodwork and leatherwork and grow their own crops. But what the Indians say, as interviewed by Bancroft, who wrote the definitive history of California in the 19th century, late 19th century, Bancroft wrote the history of California in 4 volumes. And in there, he sent out sociologists, anthropologists, archaeologists of that time to interview people. And they interviewed several of the Indians. One of the Indians says, Asis, maybe you remember, the Indian who said, we were never paid, but we were brutally whipped for reasons unknown. And the descriptions of visitors to the missions, it was terrible. Is that one person said, I think it was San Francisco, said that they never smile and they never speak. And they look very, very unhappy. Of course they were unhappy. They were enslaved there. They had to stay there for the rest of their lives until they died because Sarah wanted them kept free of sin. He didn't care about their earthly life. He could care less about the misery that they lived in the missions. And you can imagine, each mission had probably about 1,100, 1,200 people. You can imagine sewage. They could not leave the mission to go and to the toilet. They had to do it very close to the mission. Their children, the flies get in that, and the feces help spread disease. Yeah. Every night, every girl over 10 years old and unmarried girls and women whose husbands were away on another part of the missions. These were vast missions.
Let's talk about numbers, because there's no official numbers out there. I mean, according to your book, 40% of Indians were killed because of the missions. But, Valentin, what numbers do you have? I mean, how many California Indians were there?
Well, just 10 years ago, the kind of like what everyone was believing, that it was 350,000 Indians were in California prior to first contact. An interesting point to hear is that California, the coast of California, was the most populated area by indigenous people north of Mexico City. So California, you know, had the highest population of indigenous people. More recent studies are finding that the population of California Indians was more like closer to a million indigenous people here in California.
Post-contact.
Pre-contact, yes. Now, during Mission Times, there was a recent article that was published, and the author was Kevin Starr. He was a former librarian of the California State Library, and he's recognized as a real authority on California Indians. And he says that over 150,000 Indians died during the mission period, and that represented 50% of the California Indians. Mm-hmm. So those are huge numbers. And again, they all died during the mission system that was established by Junipero Serra.
And this was from 1769 to 1821.
Yes. I would like to give one more example.
Sure.
People here live, you know, we're on Ohlone lands. Let me use Ohlones.
Yeah.
At first contact, there was over 30,000 Ohlones. at first contact. At the close of the missions, there were less than 100.
Wow.
And at Mission San Juan Bautista, over 19,421 Indians died. And when I say that over 100, now they ran out of coastal Indians, and they had to start going as far, like in San Juan Bautista, as far away as Fresno, Madera, Merced, and into Stanislaus County to
because
get
they
the
were
Indians
all,
because they kept
all dying.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that coincides with what Mariano, the last Spanish Padre Presidente, Father President of the 21 Missions, says in his letter. It says, the Indians come into the missions, and within 2 years, they're dead. You have a good figure of the number of Indians who died in the missions, and that figure is about 62,000. And that is buttressed by the fact that the Franciscans were very meticulous in keeping death records. So every year, they had to file how many Indians had died, how many Indians had been born, how many Indians had been punished. But what happened was that there was always continuously about 10% of the Indians. This is deduced by Sherburne Cook, a great person who was a faculty member at Cal and went through the mission records and really came up with some solid figures. But what happened was that the runaways, or the Indians were always given 2 weeks to or a week to spend in their villages. A lot of those Indians, when they left the mission, were already sick. And as they went to their villages, they contaminated the rest of those Indians. Then visitors from other nearby tribes would get contaminated, and so you get the figure. My guess is it was far more than 150,000, maybe in 200,000.
A lot of these practices were also sadistic. You write that Indians who grieved and wept over the loss of a loved one were ordered whipped. Indian mothers who suffered miscarriage were not allowed to grieve over losing their child. Instead, they were accused of committing abortion, and at times they were whipped.
Yes, exactly. And again, the Franciscans, including Sarah, who established these policies, did not care about their life on earth.
Who carried, so if Sarah established these policies, who actually carried them out? Who did the whipping?
Initially it was the friars themselves. Now, Sarah may not have whipped any Indian, but he certainly ordered it. And he was present when they did it. Let me tell you about one incident, which is in my book. The Indians had run away from one of the missions. They were captured. They were brought back with their thumbs tied together, their babies strapped to their chest. And they took the leader. And then they sacrificed or they killed a calf. They skinned the calf. In the presence of the Franciscan friars, they knew what they were doing. And then they sewed up the leader alive into the fresh skin of the calf. Tight, very tightly sewn in there. And then they tied the skin and with the leader inside it to a post on a open field. And they left them there. Now, knowing the temperatures at that time, it was probably maybe 89 or 90 or maybe 88. You can imagine that skin began shrinking very rapidly so that he reached to the point where he could not breathe. And then he suffocated, just died inside that skin. Now, the Franciscans, again, emphasize they knew about the Franciscans. They knew they were probably there when this happened. This is how brutal they were. Many of them, when Laswin came in, most of the time he spent writing letters. Father Gonzalez wants to leave because he's fed up with and not of those words, but you know, he wants to leave because he just can't stand it here anymore. And then Laswin himself, the successor, said, I can't stand this place. I need to get out of here. They would blame what they called the savages, you know, for making life miserable for them. A survey was taken of the friars in the missions that was how the padres saw them. every single mission said, they're liars. The Indians are liars. You can't trust them. They never look you in the eye, because that was not their custom, to look people in the eye.
And yet, in some cases, when they first arrived, before the missions were even built, the Indians greeted them with fruits and food, and they resupplied
them. Right.
Today we are talking about the truth behind California's missions with Elias Castillo and Valentin Lopez. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, I'm joined by Elias Castillo. He's an award-winning journalist who wrote a new book about the history and truth about California's missions. It's A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions. I'm also joined by Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amam Mutsun Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians, which stretches from Santa Cruz to Monterey and inland to Mission San Juan Batista. And Valentin wrote the foreword to the book. He's got some interesting information, and I'll ask you about this in a few minutes, about the 40,000 fourth graders who take a field trip to San Joaquin Batista Mission every year, and I'll ask you what they learn. We have an email from Ruby who says, what horrifying information to hear. I will never look at Mission Dolores the same way. Why is the Pope canonizing Sarah? Aren't there criteria that include performing a miracle, etc.?
That's a very good question. There is a requirement that two miracles be performed, and the church has been waiting for that second miracle, and the second miracle has never happened. Interestingly, though, the very first miracle was by a nun who in 1960 was diagnosed with lupus, and she prayed to Junipero Serra, a novena to Junipero Serra, and she was cured of lupus. Well, today, lupus is recognized, is known as the great imitator to medical professionals. It's called the great imitator because it is so hard to diagnose. When I was recently telling the story of the miracles to some women at our tribe, and two women stood up and said, I was diagnosed with lupus, you know, and they said, and then it turned out to not be lupus at all. That was in 1960. You know, so is that a true miracle? And then the second thing is they're waiving the second miracle because they're saying that the life that Sarah lived was his second miracle. The other thing that they're waiving, interestingly enough, is that they normally have what's called a devil's advocate. And the devil's advocate was to go out and research everything the person did that was opposite of being a saint. You know, all the bad things or the things that would disqualify that person from being a saint. There again, the Pope said that they did not have a devil's advocate for Junipero Serra.
And Ruby also says, does the Pope have this genocidal information about the mission?
Oh, of course he does. Given the resources, at some of the talks I say, either the Pope doesn't know about this or he doesn't care. Either is unforgivable given his resources.
So Ruby says she had such positive feelings about the Pope, and a lot of people are saying he's talking about climate change. He's talking about capitalism and the poor and inequality. He even apologized for the treatment of indigenous people when he visited South America. So what do you think about that?
What has he done? He kisses babies and he says, gee, the environment is bad. Oh, that's something new. Yeah, the environment is very bad. Everybody is saying it. He says, well, gosh, the Pope has said it. Well, then it is true. Or he talks about saying, gee, if you say you're sorry about an abortion, having it, then it's okay. But what about the important stuff? Bringing women into the Catholic hierarchy. Birth control, nothing about that, which is one of the greatest problems in Latin America. Overpopulation, especially in Mexico and Brazil and some of the other poorer countries. And on top of that, he has done nothing about the wealth of the church is enormous, enormous. They still own land here in the Bay Area, all across California, that is unused. It's just laying there.
I would like to offer two answers to what you talked about. We have written letters, as your audience may know, five letters in total to Pope Francis, and they're available at our website, amamutsun.org. But In each of those letters, we've told Pope Francis, we applaud him and we support and we congratulate him on a lot of the positive steps he's doing. You know, he recognized climate change, which is huge. He talks about, he recognized genocide of the Armenians, which is about time. He also talks about, with compassion, about the poor and the disadvantaged. Those are wonderful things, and we support and we applaud them. But then he's done, if you look at his encyclical letter, he almost sounds Native American. He uses the term Mother Earth, and he talks about forming a relationship with nature. And that's exactly what our people have done for thousands of years. One thing about the encyclical letter that he talks about, though, he said it is a sin to destroy cultures, to destroy indigenous cultures, indigenous people, and indigenous environments. And that is exactly what Junipero Serra did. And for us as well in California. The second thing you mentioned was about the apology in Bolivia. He apologized for the sins, the crimes, and the offenses of the church against indigenous people. Well, what about California? Junipero Serra was a principal perpetrator of those sins, crimes, and offenses. But why is the church making him a saint? There, you know, it's just an excuse and an alibi that the church developed. And this is going to come back, and it's going to haunt them, and it's going to hurt them long term.
There's also the fact that in the 1940s, 1950s, there was an attempt by the church to canonize Serra. Very, very few people know about this. And they went through this same process of going, investigating him and filing and making a report to the Pope of why he should be canonized. Well, there was so much protest by California Indians that the church swept it away. They did not canonize it. Now, that report is not open to the public. It is hidden away, as one scholar said, who found out where it was hidden, in Santa Barbara Mission underneath a stairwell that leads up to the second floor. And that report, they did have a devil's advocate. And I think the combination of the devil's advocate saying what of his faults were, the protest by the Indians, the Vatican decided, uh-oh, let's not do this. And they dropped the whole thing. So now they're trying again. And this time, apparently it doesn't seem like they care about the horrors that he did in those death camps, the missions.
Elias Castillo is author of the new book, A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions, and Valentin Lopez is chair of the Ama Mutsan Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians, which stretches from Santa Cruz to Monterey and inland to Mission San Juan Bautista. We've got a couple emails about the other books on Serra, and Henry writes about one that was published by UC Press. And he says, you know, why are there so many recent books out here? Elias, what do you think of these recent books? Do they tell the truth or are they a whitewash?
No, they're a whitewash. They're nothing more than sycophants for the Vatican. And they're poorly researched. The conclusions are wrong. They put a silver lining on what is a terrible, horrible tragedy, not only for the world, but this nation, that the truth had not come out. Now, if you go to a state mission, there are probably two. One is in Sonoma. They're run by the state. The signage there is totally different. It says the Indians were forced into the missions. They were punished. And they're being taught how to make saddles, how to weave, and so forth. But the signage is terrible. Which, if you go to a Catholic mission, and the Catholic Church still controls most of the missions, it's the Indians flocked to the missions. They came there to learn the civilized way. Well, no, it wasn't. The first people that came to the missions were the teeny boppers, the teenagers from the Indian tribes, because they wanted to be close to the Spaniards who had steel swords, cannon, musket. They felt, gee, we join them, we'll get all of this. Well, their hopes were very quickly dashed. And it didn't take long for the Indians to realize we got to stay away from the missions. And that's when, as Val said, the missions decided, along with the friars, to go out and capture Indians and force them into the missions. And in some cases, I wasn't able to find records, but I know the Indians as Val will tell you, they would go out to the villages, take the children first. This would force the mothers to follow them into the missions. And then the husbands would have to follow because their wives and their children were in the mission. And that's how they were forced. Or they had no choice. The mission fathers trampled their fields where they would normally burn them once a year, and then they would have shoots and other food stuff. And once that was gone, the Indians had a sustainable environment, but it was very delicate, very, very delicately balanced once the missions came in. And the missions had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres. San Jose Mission, for example, extended all the way up to Oakland from San Jose, and then inland and to the edge of the bay. And each mission was like that. Their herds of livestock at each mission numbered between 25 to 30,000. And heads of cattle would be 12, 15,000. That's enough for a huge, wealthy ranch nowadays. Mm.
We have an email from Serena who says, I don't believe in sainthood, but making Sarah a saint makes me feel as people would feel about Hitler being a candidate for sainthood. It's despicable, she writes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And even though, and even having this conversation, you know, a lot of people, they say, well, let's have a debate. Was Sarah a saint or not? I mean, there should be no debate here. How come you don't see them having a debate on Adolf Hitler? Well, were the Jewish concentration camps, were they good or were they bad? You know, were they saintly or were they not saintly? There's no controversy there. If you look at slavery here in the United States, was that good or was that bad? Was that saintly or not saintly? Why are we having this a debate or a conversation about the death of 150,000 Indians whose humanity has never been recognized by the church, by the state of California, by the federal government? These are not people to them. They look at the Indians as being more related to cavemen, some distant species that nearly became extinct, and there's just a few survivors now, but they're insignificant and they don't matter. Our humanity has never been recognized, and that is horrible, and it has a horrible consequence on the members of our tribe today. You know, that whole issue of historic trauma, which we probably don't have time to talk about today, but the whole, you know, I mean, if you go 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 generations where you have no hope, where you have no love, where you have no compassion, you have no one teaching you how to live your life so that you can figure out why you're supposed to be here. If you look at our tribe, we have tremendous rates of suicide, addiction, incarceration, of violence, gang affiliations, et cetera, all looking for identity. Whereas before contact, we had a very strong identity and we had a very strong relationship with Creator. We knew why we were here.
That is Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamatsun tribal band of the Costanoan Ohlone Indians. Valentin wrote the foreword for the book A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions. We've been listening to a rebroadcast. We wanted to remember the late award-winning journalist Elias Castillo. He died on February 11th in Redwood City, California, following a brief illness. He was 80 years old. And Elias came on the show a couple of times to talk about this book. He spent many, many years on it. We thought it was important to remember Elias and to also play this show because Junipero Serra statues are being toppled. And we have noticed that in a lot of the media coverage, there just isn't much of what you just heard from Elias Castillo and Valentin Lopez. So joining us now to talk about media coverage is Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you, Mark. It was really hard to listen to that conversation because the truth about Native history is just so brutal. And like I said, we've been reading the stories about the toppling of Serra statues, and the truth is really missing from a lot of the articles.
Well, and it's so often that the word genocide is overused, and when people use it, they're not using it in a precise way. But in the case of California, it's exactly the right word. You think about the attacks on livelihood, but it was also an attack on land, relationship with the land, the relationship with the story. And I think Serra plays to that directly. And then foods, how the foods were just basically stripped from people and forced into a new structure that wasn't nearly as healthy or survivable.
You know, the other thing, Mark, is that you really need the time to go over this history. This is not something that we can share in a soundbite. I mean, we don't even have enough time with you to talk about, you know, the history of Mount Rushmore, where Trump is going to have some sort of celebration today, and Native people say you're not welcome. I mean, you really need time to go over this history.
Well, and this gets into media. I think it's really unfortunate that we have to educate with the media rather than educating throughout our system. So really these stories should be taught when someone is young. Then they start to hear more detail as they get into, say, junior high and then high school. And by college, you should have a good narrative about what this country's history really is. And that's been skipped over, so it becomes a case where the media is supposed to do it on deadline. And we're not equipped for that, and we do it poorly.
Well, and what are your thoughts, Mark, given that this is such an incredible moment? Black Lives Matter has been working for years to raise awareness about people killed by police. And here we are having really deep conversations about racism and about the past. What are your thoughts about how the media are or are not bringing Native history into these conversations?
Well, I think the media is being forced into it, both with Black Lives Matter and with Native history, because so many of these stories are intertwined. And suddenly reporters have to get to the point where if they don't explain why we got at least two steps into it, they're not going to have a story that's worth reading. And I think that's helped a lot with this. Of course, today's big breaking news, which is really extraordinary and plays into that, is that it looks like it's the end of the game for the Washington NFL team.
Right. I was just reading about that. They're going to, quote, review the dictionary-defined slur again after years and years of activism, and now you've got multinational corporations putting out threats. Mark, the other question is, what about the media, the people the media talk to, the quotes, the sources, that's really important. What strikes you about that? Because with these stories, Native voices really need to be front and center in these stories.
Well, I think it's much more than just who they talk to. It's the media's narrowness of who it hires. And that would start with everything from governance, who governs the media, to who edits and produces the shows, to who is hired to be the street representation with reporters and such, and then sources. It's all connected. And really, since the 1960s, there's been this push to have more diversity in media, and it's largely failed. And as the country gets much more diverse, in the most diverse country ever, it becomes more and more irreconcilable to have this media that's a very narrow, elite, well-educated, unrepresentative body trying to tell these stories.
And then what you get often is the word controversial. So Sarah had a, quote, controversial past, which you would never say about, you know, Hitler, for example, had a, quote, controversial past. The Washington Post ran an opinion by Salvatore Joseph Cordeleon, the Archbishop of San Francisco, called Statues of St. Junipero Serra Deserve to Stay. And I just did a quick search on Serra, and a lot of these opinion pieces are why the Serra statues deserve to stay.
And what we're fighting about is the story and what story we want to tell. And there are so many people who are comfortable with the myth they built, and they want to keep that intact because it allows them to be in charge. And as all of these, whether it be statues or symbols, come down, it's really about saying, you know, we need a world where everyone has a say. And that means changing the story and telling what really happened.
And isn't it also, Mark, about the hesitation to be honest about the true history of this country? I mean, we're going into a weekend where we're going to hear so much about the founders, the Declaration of Independence, the flag. Isn't that also part of it?
Sure. It's part of this mythology that, you keep thinking it gets defied, whether it be American exceptionalism or Manifest Destiny. The story is told in a number of different forms, but it's the same story. And in every time throughout history, it's been wrong. And yet, you see evidence after evidence. The greatest right now is coronavirus, how poorly we're doing as a country. Mm-hmm. Yet we keep this story going of American exceptionalism that's just not anywhere near what's really happening.
We have an email from Sam who writes, this morning NPR had a reading of the Declaration of Independence after there was a discussion with Yale historian David Blight. In that discussion, Mr. Blight said, we can admire the genius of those principles. Sam wrote, I find it incredibly offensive that the professor would call a racist statement, essentially naming Native Americans as savages without ethics or morals, genius. And Sam said, why wasn't this line addressed in the discussion?
That's a really good point. And the irony of that is that so much of the founding principles came from the Iroquois Confederacy and the democracy that existed before the United States.
And Mark, to your point about who's making the decision, who's hosting the shows, the American Society of News Editors reported that in 2018, across the 184 digital and print outlets that responded to their annual diversity survey, there were only 41 Native journalists employed. According to the Native American Journalism Association and their Reclaiming Truth study from 2017, Native journalists represent just 0.2% of mainstream media employees, 0.2%.
To put that number in perspective, with the election of Deb Haaland and Sharice Davidson to the last Congress, Congress is now at 0.76%, so three times better than the media. And the idea that politicians are doing better than the news media ought to rankle every editor everywhere.
Hmm. Wow. What are you hearing from Native journalists about these issues? There's a very important discussion about Black journalists along the same lines, about racism in the newsroom, about trying to get through to white editors. What are you hearing from Native journalists about these issues?
Well, I've really gone through an evolution because for most of my career, I worked really hard to try to get newsrooms to be more diverse and to talk to editors about that. And since taking this job at Indian Country Today, my thinking is now just the opposite. It's we're going to do it ourselves. We don't care what the media is doing. They're not telling the story we need to hear, and they're not reaching our audiences. And I'll give you one example. Our number one demographic is 25 to 34, and very few people in the media can say that. I think the idea of a master narrative from mainstream media has failed, and it's time to move on and look for better ways to tell the story.
What are your thoughts, Mark? We have just a couple minutes left. Trump is on his way to Mount Rushmore. And now that the media are really exploring the true history of this country, bringing on different voices, how do you think the media should report on this event and what's going to happen there?
Well, it's offensive in just so many ways. I mean, it's offensive when there's a pandemic to have a mass gathering where people are by choice not wearing masks or doing any kind of precautions. It's a total indictment of the way the South Dakota tribes are viewed. This is their land. It's sacred land. And to be able to not even be part of that conversation from the federal government, which is, has an obligation to consult with tribes on issues like this, is irresponsible.
Yeah, and irresponsible that the Republican governor said you don't have to social distance and you don't have to wear a mask.
Exactly. Who's not only that, but she has tried to order and tried to get the Trump administration to prevent tribes from stopping people from coming into their own communities who might carry the virus.
Wow. Well, we will keep an eye on how this is covered and then report on it. Final thoughts, Mark. Given that you are the editor of Indian Country Today, is there any room for collaboration with more mainstream outlets to ensure that your stories have a wider reach?
Absolutely. And I think that's really the way forward, is to work collaboratively rather than trying to remake the media. And we do that all the time. And I think that's a good process. One of the things we're doing is moving into the television sphere. And one of the reasons for that is we want to get people who don't know they're interested in these stories, and they see for the first time a Native reporter telling something that they've never heard before. Mm-hmm. And that we're looking forward to seeing how that changes the narrative.
Yeah, and also, whenever we do these shows, and we do them fairly regularly, probably more than other non-Native stations, the reaction is huge, Mark. I mean, people really want this information.
I agree. And you do a great job with that.
Well, final thoughts, Mark. What are you working on right now?
Well, right now it's been all NFL this morning. The team, the NFL league is saying that it is the end and they are going to change the name. And so we're working on basically histories, how this came about. This has been a long, long fight for a lot of people, including legal action. And you don't want to actually have people claim victory until it actually crosses the finish line. But this is past the point now of inevitability.
Yeah, I'm seeing some D.C. reporters say that they're hearing from the owner of that team that the name is definitely going away.
Yep.
That's just really, it's such a wild time, Mark.
Just like that. I mean, it happened so fast. And you look at history, and that's how often that does. You see these big fights that last for years and years. Right. And then one side just gives in.
Wow. Well, thanks for your reporting, Mark, as always, and thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Mark Trahant is editor of Indian Country Today, and you can find their website, IndianCountryToday.com, to read more about the end of a mascot, Washington NFL team to review, in quotes, its dictionary-defined slur. You can also find information about the late Elias Castillo's work at YourCallRadio.org. If all of this information about the missions, at least the deep history of it, is new to you, I hope you can take the time to read his important book, A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions. And if you'd like to share today's show with friends or your circle, you can find it at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our podcast there. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.